They call it dual-use, technology with civilian as well as military applications. It's a policy that promises to create jobs and keep stockholders happy. We'll look at defense conversion today. I'm Jude Tillman, and this is the Communications Revolution. The Clinton administration came into office and promised Pentagon cutbacks, encouraging military contractors to transfer their weapons technology into civilian use. It was hoped that the most advanced radar, missile guidance, and computer tracking systems might now be used in transportation, education, and communication. Some critics charge that it just isn't working. Defense contractors still want to build weapons, and nobody seems ready or willing to turn swords into plowshares. We'll take a look at the dual-use aspect of defense reinvestment with a panel of experts. From Monitor Radio in Washington, D.C., we're joined by Dr. Kenneth Flamm, who is Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Economic Security and Special Assistant to the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Dual-Use Technology Policy, and Dr. Gregory Bishak, an economist and the Executive Director of the National Commission for Economic Conversion and Disarmament. Here in the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, we have Carol Webb, who is with the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council, focusing on economic conversion, and is a member of the board of the Defense Space Consortium of Joint Venture Silicon Valley. Our discussion begins after this report from producer Alex Vanoss.
I don't know about you, but I'm one of those people who still manages to find a use for fossil technology, like the manual typewriter. It gives you good exercise, it gets your fingers nice and inky when you change the ribbon, and it never crashes and erases your entire manuscript. It's not that I've got anything against computers. In fact, I've got one myself stored in the closet here. But it's a fossil, too. 14 years old, and it sort of works. In a way, my lifestyle's a little like the United States economy, because America, after the Cold War, is dealing with a fossil in its closet, a very expensive, state-of-the-art, yet soon-to-be-passé, military-industrial complex. That is, the defense industry that eats into the national budget, adds to the national debt, but is now in the process of downsizing. Trouble is, how do you downsize all those top guns and tracking systems and satellites and computer networks? And how do you downsize all the hundreds of thousands of employees who design or make or manage these systems? How will they all pay the rent now that they can't rely on a steady Pentagon paycheck, now that the buck has stopped? Period. It's a vast and complicated picture. Not all workers are threatened by defense conversion, nor are all contractors. In fact, one of them, the 93-year-old TRW Corporation, is doing well. TRW's into everything from satellite communications to submarine warfare. The company's lifeblood is high technology and changing technology.
Technology has always been, I think, an engine for economic growth. And certainly the technology in the United States today and over the next 10 years will create more growth in the economy and more jobs. Is just going to be different than it has in the past.
James Agee is with TRW's Systems Integration Group. As far back as 1985, he says, TRW forecast a downturn in defense spending, so the company branched into other areas like airport security and smart highway systems. They also found ways to apply defense technology to law enforcement, for example, fingerprint identification.
One program that we used to have, and still do to this day, is dealing with the sounds of submarines underwater. It's the filtering of that noise, that information, and trying to pick out of it significant details. If you take that and compare it to fingerprints, where you have a large number of ridges, points where the ridges join and so forth, there's a lot of amount of data that is contained in a fingerprint. The job that we have identified is to scan it, find the points for identification, and then use that information to go against very, very large databases of existing fingerprints.
TRW is doing well financially, but still has laid off hundreds of workers. And other high-tech firms in aerospace, electronics, and telecommunications have sent home thousands. Critics charge that high technology is a cover for automation, for example, replacing telephone operators with switching systems and computer voices. Barbara Warden is deputy legislative director with the United Automobile Workers. Automation, she says, has become a major labor issue.
What we're wanting to make happen is when companies make a decision to move into high technology production, that there be conditions set, especially if there is federal funding involved, that there be job retention and job creation as conditions for those companies receiving grants or other kinds of awards or other kinds of funding.
High technology can threaten jobs. On the other hand, when it comes to telecommunications, it's a fact that many new consumer items have been spawned within defense, and new areas of commercial production can, in theory, spawn more jobs, says Andrew Jenks, a reporter with the trend-watching journal Washington Technology. Take, for example, the Internet.
The Internet itself was originally created by the Defense Department in the 1960s to provide a means of communication between Pentagon computers in the event of a nuclear war. And as a result, we now have this thing called the Internet, which is growing just leaps and bounds, 30 million users and generating lots of jobs. Another example that's having commercial impact is global positioning systems. This is a network of 20-some-odd satellites that the Defense Department put up to provide tracking for soldiers so that they could know where they are relative to the enemy. Now we're seeing GPS receivers emerging in electronic shops all over the place. People to go hiking are beginning to buy them. The intelligent vehicle highway systems, cars will soon be outfitted with GPS receivers as an option, and in fact it's already happening in Japan. People use them for navigating their boats.
This one will give you, this is your hypothetical away point, and then that's your boat, and if you're off course to the right or to the left, this boat will move, and these graphics move toward you and will give you the heading to correct your course to get to the point which you like to get to.
So I almost don't have to look where I'm going, I can just look at this little screen?
You always should look where you're going.
Well, okay, I'm sold now. What's the cheapest one you've got?
They start at $379. Oh, and the most expensive would probably be in the $2,000 range. This one will play music.
It's unclear whether even GPS telecommunications can help one navigate the shoals and hazards of the political system here in Washington, D.C., where defense conversion has strong White House support. Here is where Dorothy Robine, a special assistant to the president for economic policy, has helped steer technology development and defense conversion. But instead of conversion, Robine prefers the term defense reinvestment in technology and skills.
I think it presents tremendous challenges to the federal government, both to assure, in the president's words, that the men and women who won the Cold War are not left out in the cold, but also to assure that we can meet future military needs with a smaller defense budget.
Dorothy Robine's been pushing the concept of dual use. Instead of simply beating swords into plowshares or squashing tanks into toasters, dual use seeks to give incentives to telecommunications and other high-tech programs that have both defense and consumer applications. Take, for example, flat panel screens for computers. They're what make laptops possible, and they're used in the new generation of fighter planes and tanks. Because of their potential market, Robine says we need to start making them en masse in America. Right now, most of them come from Japan.
A flat panel display will be as essential to a general in a war in the next century as maps were to George Meade at Gettysburg. So we have concluded that we need to try to jumpstart or foster manufacturing capability in this country.
Well, I might just be ready to turn in my old fossil here for a laptop. And dual use may be the savior for the defense corporations. Question is, do these technologies also promise a future for defense workers, or will they, in the long run, eliminate jobs? For For Jerry Agee with TRW Corporation, now is a time of transition. Jobs lost in California, maybe jobs gained in the East, he says. Jobs lost in aerospace may show up as new jobs in telecommunications and information systems. But what's more, says Agee, this time of transition may be the harbinger of a future time of return.
For me personally, I'm a great believer in the pendulum, that it swings from one direction to another consistently. And we'll probably see defense and space come back again in perhaps ways we don't yet envision, but it will come back.
Like a new war? A new Cold War?
I don't want to get into that.
This is Alex Fanos for the Communications Revolution.
Do we need another cold or hot war to keep the economy healthy? It's been going on this way for so long, it seems Washington can't get motivated to devote resources to anything other than weapons. I'm Jude Tillman. Let's pose the broad question to our guests. Carol Webb with the South Bay Labor Council, AFL-CIO, Joint Venture Silicon Valley, and the Center for Economic Conversion. You have some very concrete experience in this regard. Why does it seem to you, or to me at least at this point, that companies are simply not interested in civilian applications or even dual use?
I think the bottom line, Jude, is that there's not enough profits in it at the moment. So we have been approaching a local company, FMC, where we've had enormous numbers of job losses, and said to them, we're interested. They have an electric drivetrain technology, which we think would be very useful in advanced transportation industries. And we've said to them, how can we help develop this industry? What would it look like to replace building tanks with building electric buses? They say, you can guarantee markets, you can guarantee profits. We might be interested in talking about this. So bottom line is, where are the profits in these new industries?
If you can guarantee markets, if you can guarantee profits. Now, the government has to some extent tried to do this in some industries. Ken Flam, you're the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, advising the Defense Secretary on dual use. How do you respond to this hesitancy on the part of companies? How's dual use going to work if companies want to be guaranteed markets and profits before they'll begin to invest in it?
Well, I think the bottom line is, for a civilian application to be attractive, there has to be some potential for profit in the long run. And if a company is unconvinced that they're going to earn a return, even with some degree of assistance in getting into the market, then it just doesn't look like a very likely application. Electric cars sound good. There are companies investing in electric cars, and we are helping companies make investments in clean energy technology for transportation purposes. So I suggest that the company you're talking about is the exception rather than the rule.
Carol Webb, you're familiar with a lot of situations like this, a lot of technologies that are not being developed into civilian use. Isn't that true?
Well, we hear in Silicon Valley that there are really thousands and thousands of technologies that are sitting on shelves at Livermore Laboratories, at local companies, that there's really very little chance of them ever being deployed or finding some way to put them to use commercially and create jobs in the local community.
So is it your sense that the government needs to offer some dollars by way of incentive to get them to do this?
Well, I think to help them take the technologies off, and also to try to figure out what is the way that we're going to help companies or encourage the development of new industries in our local communities. What kind of assistance are we going to need besides just technology assistance? And who's going to, if private capital has to lead all of this and they're not doing it, how do we develop really the push to try to create these new industries in our community?
Greg Bishak, you're with the National Commission for Economic Conversion and Disarmament. Do you agree with Carol Webb's assessment you're going to need federal dollars to push private industry into this?
I think it's not just a matter of federal dollars, but it's also a matter of reorienting the large defense firms. Some are, in fact, reorienting themselves. For instance, Hughes has, in fact, identified a number of growth markets where there's relevant civilian applications of their technologies. But many are resistant. Many are hunkering down, trying to get a bigger piece of a shrinking pie. They see the defense market as a market that, of guaranteed profits, something they're comfortable with. Their management style, their technology style fits with this. And to some extent, I think that the defense tilt of the dual-use program actually encourages them to stay in defense applications, to look askance at the commercial applications in many cases. And also there's some doubt as to whether or not in the case of markets that are being driven by federal procurement, federal regulations, state regulations, and city regulations, perhaps in this case clean air, environmental regs. It's not real clear how these regulations are going to be in the near term and even the longer term, what the market will shape up like. So some of the producers are hesitant, and in part this is due to the battle of the big three automakers over trying to roll back some of these regulatory standards. Part of that harkens back to the 1970s when people tried to get into light rail transit. We had Boeing Vertol that tried to produce light rail cars. What ultimately undermined their effort to a large extent was, one, their defense culture, where they're trying to produce things just like they did in the defense industry for municipal markets, and two, the changing standards and regulation for the light rail industry and transportation system. We should learn from those lessons and not repeat these errors in the post-Cold War conversion.
Well, Greg Bishak, you've just introduced a lot of points, and I want to give you a chance to respond to them, Ken Flam. But tell us, the defense tilt of dual use, is that an accurate phrase?
Well, I think you have to remember a couple things. First of all, there is a defense tilt in dual use in the sense that it is expected. The Defense Department is in the defense business. Defense is job one for us. We're here because we're here to defend the national security. Now, it's also true we have to be concerned about the industrial base. And there is a new philosophy that pervades the Department of Defense that says that wherever possible, we're going to try to tap into that commercial technology, commercial products, commercial systems, leverage off of commercial markets, and contribute to the commercial industrial infrastructure wherever we can with our investments. But you can't forget that the purpose of the Department of Defense is to provide the common defense. And we're in a regime of declining budgets. We have a lot of new challenges. You look around you in the world today, and we have a lot of responsibilities we're trying to meet in the best way we can. We're doing all this on declining dollars.
Some critics would suggest, though, that this defense tilt is true on behalf of military use, when in fact what the Defense Department should be thinking about is the global economic warfare. The defense of the United States interests means economic warfare as well as military warfare.
Well, I disagree. I think that what we're talking about is a system. As an economist, I disagree with you. I don't think it's global economic warfare. Global economic warfare says it's a zero-sum game, that we can't gain from being in competition and cooperation with one another. And there are very real economic challenges, and this Department of Defense and the Clinton administration recognizes, much more so than any previous administration, I believe, that the national security of the U.S. rests firmly on the economic infrastructure.
Carol Webb, using this idea of Greg's suggestion of a defense tilt on dual use versus Ken's suggestion of leveraging, using military dollars to leverage civilian application, your experience with the centerpiece of the Defense Reinvestment Program, the TRP, Technology Reinvestment Program, has been what?
Well, I think this, I was wanted to respond about the dual use piece, the TRP grants, and I think part of the problem is that it's become clearer and clearer that it really is about developing defense technology and not about commercialization. And as people understand that, it's like, okay, what does that mean for local communities? But I think it has been heralded as kind of the center of the conversion program of the Clinton administration, saying that this is how we're going to get to downstream production, this is how we're going to get to new industries. And a recent Rutgers study showed really that only 16% of the dollars, TRP dollars, went to technology deployment, and even close to 5% for really downstream production. So it's like the tilt is really towards defense, and also doesn't have what we thought was the promise of the Clinton administration that was going to be job creating.
You're listening to the Communications Revolution. You can contact us via email at kpfa@well.com. And if you want to continue this discussion online after the show, join our Internet IRC channel at TRP8. That's TRP8. Ken Flam, what is your response to job? Is job creation part of your mandate?
Well, wherever possible, we're going to seek ways of creating new high growth, high wage, good jobs in the future. But we have a long-term strategy. We're investing in technology because over the medium and long term, we expect that to be the foundation of the future economy and of our future defense. The bottom line is, in the short run, that is over the next few years, there's going to be some pain in the defense industry. There's no way around that. Our procurement dollars have come down something over 40% since their peak in the mid to late 1980s, and the industry is shrinking. There's no way around that. How do you cope with that? Well, in the short run, you try to help communities deal with those problems. You try to help the people who are being displaced from those industries deal with that problem. We are putting substantial resources in those areas. We're working closely with other government agencies to deal with those problems. But the real out, the real long-run solution to both the defense problem and the economic problem is to invest in technology. That is, in creating the good jobs, the new industries, the jobs of the future that are going to provide for the economic growth of the future.
Well, I want to take a look at this premise that technology means growth and jobs. In the manufacturing industries, which include high tech, they currently employ 16% of the national workforce, and that's down from 20%
two decades ago. Software and services are technology, too.
That might be so. I'm talking about just high-tech manufacturing. The trend among many people say high-tech is just a cover for automation and that the trend really is to lose jobs. High-tech is not going to produce jobs. How do you respond to that?
I respond to that by saying there have been studies for years and years and years that have looked at the subject. And generally, there's no definitive answer. There's no doubt that certain unskilled jobs, less skilled jobs, are displaced by automation and by technology. But it's also true that vast new industries are created by technology. And if you ask the question, is there any evidence that dual-use technology is going to create these vast new industries, these vast new jobs, I say look at the history of dual-use technology. Look, it is Defense Department investment in computers, for example, which plays an important role in the development of the computer industry, of the software industry, of the high-performance communications industry that is sweeping this country right now and which your show is about. It is Defense Department investment that created the aerospace industry that we're talking about, that has an aerospace industry that is unparalleled in the world today in terms of the quality of the products and its dominance of those markets.
Semiconductors,
another good example, mm-hmm. there in Silicon Valley.
We just lost, in the last 10 years, 30,000 semiconductor manufacturing jobs. So I think that's part of the crisis and crunch is what kind of jobs are we creating, what's it look like, and what's happening to the whole middle-class manufacturing sector in this country that are being displaced as defense disappears. So, and how can we enter into that in terms of creating new industries that are going to replace these? But yes, there's new industries created, but at the same time we're losing thousands and thousands of jobs.
Greg Bishak, let's let you into this conversation. Greg?
Yes, I think one of the key problems is that the path that's being chosen by the dual-use initiative is essentially going to skew our research and development priorities, our industrial priorities, and I don't think that the bets that are being made are really the right bets. In fact, we're still pursuing technological military superiority. We're essentially still experiencing the hangover, the Cold War rivalry with our now defunct rival, the former Soviet Union. And now the DOD, in justifying many of these priorities that are in fact the key technologies that are driving the dual-use initiative, are being justified because we're facing more and more likely enemies armed with Western technology, advanced Western technology. This points to the fact that technology in this case is not the solution. In fact, what we need is to curtail the high-tech arms trade, that there's other ways of getting at security instead of simply pursuing military technological security, reconvening the Permanent Five and the Security Council to talk about curtailing arms trade is in fact a serious initiative that gets us around the expensive path of investing in new high technology to maintain air, land, and sea military superiority. The dual-use initiative does not deal with the excess capacity, which is immense in this country and worldwide in the defense industry, on the order of easily 40% to 50% excess capacity in the aircraft, the space, the mm-hmm. shipbuilding industries are even greater in excess capacity.
This is the centerpiece
of our initiative.
Before we get off too long on this, I think it's important to recognize that overall the volume of defense exports and military trade has shrunk considerably over the last few years. But
Ken Flynn, would you agree that there's, even getting off on the larger point that Greg was making, I'm going to ask a pointed question about it,
that this is
redundancy
slanted towards military uses? I just disagree entirely mm-hmm. with that. If you look at what we're investing in, It's basically oriented at creating new commercial technologies that over the long run will have relevance for defense.
Well, let me ask
but
about one particular
that's an enormously broad
system.
Array of technologies. And if you look at the historical record, again, in things like software and computers and communications and semiconductors and aircraft, you name it, the evidence are that this is a high payoff economic growth strategy. But that's not why we're doing it. We're doing it for defense, but it's good. It's beneficial that it has these economic impacts.
The way I've been reading the terrain in the last few months, it seems that the technology is more spin-on than spin-off. Isn't that true, that from the civilian sector we're getting the newest, most cutting-edge technology, technological development that's being then bought for military use?
In some key areas, that's definitely true. If you're talking about the rate, it's not so much that defense is not pushing the technological frontier in key areas, because that continues to be the case. I think what you're referring to is the fact that in important ways, the rate at which new technology is incorporated into fielded production systems has lagged in some key areas, notably semiconductors, notably computers, because it takes us so long through our acquisition and procurement process to incorporate that new technology into defense systems.
Not because defense suppliers are dinosaurs and are not cutting-edge competitors.
No, I disagree with that. In many cases, the defense suppliers are identical to the commercial suppliers. It's just that we've encrusted the system with so many bureaucratic and regulatory barnacles that even normal right-thinking commercial folks have to slow down and react to the impossible rules that we've imposed on them in the past. And we're doing something
all
about
right.
that.
Well, you just heard from Ken Flam, who advises the Defense Secretary on dual use. We're discussing reinvestment of military high-tech dollars into civilian products. You've been hearing also from Carol Webb, who's with the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council and is on the boards of the Center for Economic Conversion and the California Network for a New Economy. And also Greg Bishak, who is an economist and the executive director of the National Commission for Economic Conversion and Disarmament. I'm Jude Tillman, and this is the Communications Revolution. We'd like to hear from you right now. You can join our discussion with questions and comments by calling 1-800-848-2298. That's 1-800-848-2298. We'll be right back.
The Communications Revolution is produced at KPFA, Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, with funds from the Telecommunications Education Trust, established by the California Public Utilities Commission. It's distributed by Pacifica National Programming. Barry Scott is the executive producer. The associate producer is Carol Klinger. The managing editor is John Rieger. The associate editor is Claire Schoen. For a cassette tape or a written transcript of this program, call the Pacifica Radio Archive at 1-800-735-0230 and ask for the Communications Revolution, Program 894. This is the Communications Revolution.
Simply can't continue to afford its own private defense industry, and it can't get the cutting-edge technology it needs without bringing the walls down and integrating the defense and the commercial sectors.
That was Dorothy Robine, Special Assistant to the President for Economic Policy. Ken Flam, what do you say about that accusation? Isn't it true that this fossilized military-industrial complex needs to be sort of blown out of the water to make room for a new way of doing business?
Well, a fossil is dead by definition. The bottom line, I think, is that if you look at, there certainly are defense industries out there, and our entire thrust is directing them away. We've told them, directing them away from defense, the defense orientation they've conventionally had on just defense systems. We've told them, basically, that in the future, wherever possible, we're going to eliminate the defense industry. That is, and that's an exaggeration, and what I mean by that is that we're going to try to break down that barrier between defense and commercial. Wherever possible, we're going to use commercial. Now, in some areas where we have defense-unique products or systems, we're going to have to continue to rely on defense contractors to have those capabilities, and if necessary, we're going to make sure we have the capabilities we require. But we've basically put the defense industry on notice that they're going to be competing against a much broader group of suppliers. They're going to be in competition with commercial suppliers of products and technologies. They're going to have to deal with that competition. They're going to have to change their ways to meet that competition. And we've also taken steps for guys who are already in the business to try to help them adjust to that new reality. We think the key thing we can do is work with them to try to take the technology they've developed for military applications and port it and move it to commercial markets. But we also think it's important to get commercial firms into the defense acquisition community, supplying us with technologies and products which we can afford, which will allow us to keep up with new technology.
We're talking about defense reinvestment today. You can call us with your questions and comments at 1-800-848-2298, 1-800-848-2298. Let's bring our first caller into the program from Alameda. We hear from John. Hello, John.
Hello, I'm John Therapy, and I'd like to know where we could get information, or I could get it mailed to my house, on technologies for all our subcommittees so that we can use the information. And I'm a high idea man, by the way. I think 9 out of 19 ideas were mine, but for instance, I circulate 12 movies in a computer organization to help Science City and help the others, like Asset. But how can we get the information? Where do we get the information? Could you mail it to my house? Could I give you telephone number later? And I have tremendous imagination. I deal through God, democracy. I want to start the GDC Performance Center, by the way. God, democracy, and capitalism.
Right.
Can I give you a suggestion?
All right, thanks, John, for your call. Go ahead.
There's a telephone number, 1-800-DUAL-USE, which will connect you to the Advanced Research Projects Agency, TRP, Information Center. TRP, by the way, is only one of the many dual-use programs that DOD has going. I can talk about that more. But 1-800-DUAL-USE is a good start, John.
Right, let's hear from Jennifer in San Jose.
Hi.
Hi, Jennifer.
My name is Jennifer, and my experience is I'm a computer operator. I used to work for Lawrence Livermore, and I'm currently working for a biotechnical company. My question is the role of I would like your participants to talk about the role of private capital in the defense conversion. The example initially you gave earlier in the program was internet, and now that it's gone more public, people are actually capitalizing on that and making new jobs. The other example I would use is Unix, and it's like the public sector is taking over from the defense company those kind of products.
Jennifer, thank you very much for your call. The internet is its origins were in the defense industry, and I'm in our opening report for this program. It was suggested that the internet has created thousands of jobs. Are there other areas that any of you, any of my guests, can identify in which the public sector is taking over something that originated with the defense sector?
I think Jennifer meant where the private sector is taking stuff that has originated with defense spending is the example, really, that she's giving there.
Well, that was her first question. I think I'm also interested in the public sector, but go ahead, Ken, if you have examples.
Well, sure, there's many examples like that. Internet's a great example. RISC, microprocessors is something Defense Department supported. Of course, that's a whole active area in the semiconductor and computer industries. Computer timesharing, advanced computer graphics. Defense Department currently leads the research and educational world in things like computer simulation and modeling, has helped sponsor work that is spawning new jobs every day now. If you use a Macintosh computer, the mouse attached to that computer builds on DoD research that goes back to the 1960s. The first Windows or Macintosh-like interfaces for computers came out of defense-sponsored R&D projects.
A very impressive list, Ken.
We can keep going.
That's one of the things we often talk about is like industries in Silicon Valley like to say that they did this themselves, but we are all very sure that there were public dollars that helped move this all forward. So
sure.
We
Actually,
would acknowledge that certainly in the Valley.
Some of them aren't so shy. If you go talk to Sun, they'll tell you up front the role that the DoD and ARPA support
Sun
played in the evolution of Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not overplay the DoD and ARPA at this point in time. The question is whether or not the DoD and ARPA's mission is exhausted. And in fact, we have other national needs that are bona fide needs that are underfunded at this point in time. And after all, the DoD, in terms of total federal R&D dollars, absorbs at least 56% of federal R&D spending. That's a generous estimate in the favor of the commercial application. Wait a minute, Ken. The issue here is we have a sustainable technologies initiative that the administration has put forward, but we don't necessarily have the money in the pipeline to deal with serious issues of pollution avoidance, sustainable and zero emissions manufacturing technology, alternative energy and transportation technologies. And I don't think that we need to run these kind of initiatives through TRP. If we want green technologies, let's have a green R&D program. There are huge opportunity costs here, and they will leverage serious private investment dollars. We're talking about a domestic and international market that totals over $300 billion annually in the environmental goods and services market. This is the growth market of the future. These are, in fact, the new missions where I believe we ought to be investing our R&D dollars instead of one that's exhausted and is busy trying to justify itself now with essentially overdone military apparatus, which is still, if you look at the president's plan, going to leave procurement at a higher level in real terms than it was in 1975, research and development in real terms at a higher level than it was in 1975, operations and maintenance in the DOD budget. The only thing that's being cut in real terms is the personnel for the military personnel. And perhaps the atomic energy defense missions will be cut, too.
Greg Bishek is with the National Commission for Economic Conversion and Disarmament. I really want to let our listeners get in on this. Our number is 1-800-848-2298, 1-800-848-2298. Let's hear from Berkeley. Roman is on the phone. Welcome to the program, Roman.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning. My question is in reference to the example given of the FMC's wanting guaranteed profits in terms of converting their technologies to civilian use. My question is that once they were guaranteed money to research and develop this technology in the first place during the 80s, isn't there some kind of responsibility, given that the taxpayers paid for the research in the first place, that they should somehow convert it without having those guarantees? Maybe they should take a risk now since they haven't had to in the first place to develop a technology?
Thank you very much for your call, Roman. Carol Webb.
I would definitely agree with that. I think one of our concerns is the enormous numbers of dollars that have been invested that don't lead to any job creation. And what is the responsibility when there has been this kind of public investment to then actually create jobs and use this technology in a way that's going to serve the community? And I think what we've seen for years and years is, well, in the case of FMC, it's like billions of dollars, millions of dollars invested in this, public dollars invested in the company. Now they're going to walk away with the technology, with the jobs, leave a piece of polluted land sitting in the middle of the community. So I think definitely there should be some kinds of job creation criteria that are created, that are connected to all these kinds of investments of public dollars.
Our number is 1-800-848-2298, 1-800-848-2298. The topic today is defense reinvestment. Very quickly, Ken, because I do want to let our listeners join
us. I'd just like to point out that we, too, agree that jobs should be created, but when you start talking about job creation criteria, you got to remember that if we're successful, the jobs we're going to be creating are not tomorrow. They're going to be 4, 5, 10 years off, and they're going to be big jobs, big numbers. So when you start talking about job creation, the key question to ask is when. You know, when are you? Nobody is talking about guaranteeing anybody profits, by the way. That may be what somebody wants, but that is not the Department of Defense philosophy. Furthermore, we agree that environmental and technology investments, such as Greg were talking about, are a good idea. That's just not what we happen to be investing in, but there are other folks in this administration who are putting significant resources into it.
From Los Angeles, let's bring in Adrian. Hello, Adrian. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I wanted to discuss the past record of the defense spending in this country. They have black budgets. We don't know really how much is spent on them. They have innumerable scandals and overruns and $600 hammers and things like that. It seems to me that we should be trying to disengage ourselves from this whole thing and not turn over another portion of our economy to this particular type of industry, which has never been labor intensive. It's always been capital intensive, and it's our capital. And is there any possibility that we can go a different direction and just dump the Department of Defense and call it a war department and activate it when we have a war? That was it.
Thank you very much.
That's fine. And Yeah, you'll excuse me if I get a little bit perturbed when I hear that, so that when the war starts, at that point we start worrying about defense, right? It just seems to me that that's not a very realistic way to deal with the world we live in. I just like to point out, however, that when you say, you know, when you talk about our bespeckled record, you got to think about the big picture here. We're a large organization that's been trying to do something for the last 50 years. That certainly there are things that have been done less efficiently than possible, and this administration has recognized this. We've been pushing to change the way we do business. We've been pushing to change it. I personally, however, and I bring this perspective before I took this job in the not-so-distant past, I personally think that if you look at the history of advanced technology investments by the Department of Defense, it's a sterling history. It's a history of how something can work. And if you look at the high technology industry in this country, there's no doubt in my mind, and again, I brought this perspective coming into this job, that if you look at the history of high tech in this country, that it is integrally linked up, our technological lead, those high technology jobs, that is integrally linked to the history of investments in advanced technology the Department of Defense made since the end of World War II. And do I think that's exhausted? Should we pack up our bags and go home? The era of information technology has passed. I disagree. I say wake up and smell the gigabytes. There's a revolution going out there that's going to revolutionize the economy, and it's building on investments that we've made for the last 50 years. And I think continuing, accelerating those investments in that information technology is a good thing. That's going to make the future for this country.
With all due respect, I think the popular lay image of Pentagon dollars is $1,000 toilet seats and a lot of waste and fraud. And you're waging a valiant fight today, Ken Flam, to counter that image. But nonetheless, that image is in people's minds.
Well, that's your image, perhaps, but I don't necessarily have to agree with it. If you say that the acquisition process historically has developed a lot of problems, I have to be the person to agree with you. I agree with you 100%. Bill Perry, the Secretary of Defense, agrees with you. And we're trying to do something about it. But if you look at that isolated, not that isolated, that portion of the defense budget, which has pushed the most advanced technology for defense and for this nation, I think that's a good record. If you look at the record of the Advanced Research Projects Agency, for example, which is the flagship institution leading the charge on dual-use technology, that's an outstanding record, and I challenge anyone to, I'm willing to debate anytime, any place, anywhere on the record of ARPA.
We'll come back to the point many times. Our number again is 1-800-848-2298 if you would like to join this challenging debate. From Santa Rosa, we have Jack on the phone. Hello, Jack.
Hello. In addressing this gentleman's most recent statement, one of my close friends works as a technician at Mare Island Naval Shipyard. He's very upset with the fact that the work he's doing, which is heavy research and assembly of electronic components, are one-of-a-kind pieces designed for specific purposes or specific sets of weapon systems. They're not going to filter back into our society. They're not going to contribute anything but create more paranoia. Number two, where does this great and grand communications revolution going to relieve the pain and suffering which is occurring with people on the street? I think our finances need to be applied to more humanitarian and compassionate purposes. I'll take my response on the air.
Thank you very much for your call, Jack, from Santa Rosa. Greg Bishek, it comes back around to the point you were making earlier. Defense grants, military investment, just pork barrel politics. Is that right?
Well, there's two things. One is the research agenda, which ARPA and the rest of DOD has set out, is really driven by defense missions that emerged late in the Cold War, and they're continuing to sell it. Now they're using different threats, but when you add up the Koreas, the Libyas, the Iraqs, and Irans, you don't get a boogeyman as big as the former Soviet Union. You can't justify these kind of programs, nor can you justify the so-called defense unique capabilities, the Seawolf submarines, the CVN-76 aircraft carriers, and everything else, which is being built in the name of preserving a defense industrial base. But as Carol Webb can attest, we're halfway through the defense industry downsizing according to the Clinton plan, halfway through the pain. There's estimated 1.3, 1.4 million defense industry workers that are going to be laid off under this. We're about halfway through, close to 700,000 being laid off now. That means there's another 700,000 that are going to be laid off in these high-skill, high-wage jobs. And it's not clear that we need to spend more money on these things. The conversion program was supposed to be a job bridge between the declining industries and occupations of the defense sector and the growing and emerging ones in both the private and public sector. And the public sector needs are what are being underfunded at this point in time when you take a look at serious national needs in environment, transportation, the inner cities, rebuilding our cities, our infrastructure. You take a look at that, the civilian research and development agenda that Clinton laid out is not being funded the way you promised. The infrastructure program he laid out, there's net change, zero change in the president's public fixed investment budget in infrastructure, civilian R&D, retraining, and this is essentially what's happening. We have no channeling of these research and procurement dollars into these real critical needs that this gentleman was speaking of, and that's because these other systems are sopping up the money.
What comes to mind, in my mind, is what was referenced in the earlier report about sort of the fossilized defense industry that's owned by the Defense Department, and the question of whether we could
the
convert.
The Defense Department
Ken,
does not
let
own
me finish,
defense
Ken,
industry.
Can the that was the reference that the advisor to the president made. She must have some basis for her opinion. But the question that comes to my mind: if we could harness all of those wonderful energies that you refer to in the Department of Defense to something that's a grand social program, sort of along the lines of what was done with the WPA and some of those things in the 30s, instead of always having military agendas set the investment agenda that's happened since World War II. Carol Webb.
The fossilized industries at least created jobs for working class folks and for communities. It's like an enormous percentage of folks that work in defense are people of color and women. And at least when we built tanks in San Jose, we created jobs for people that lived there. Mm-hmm. High tech may spin off some jobs in the future, but they're very, very technical, take very high qualified people to do them. So the new kind of investment that we're talking about does not create the kind of broad-based jobs that the old fossilized defense industry created.
Ken Flem?
What it really means is that the United States is going to have to make an investment in its people. It's going to have to make an investment in educating people. It's going to have to make an investment in giving people skills. And it's going to have to enable people to cope with the changing world economy.
Let's bring in Todd from Los Angeles here and keep the ball rolling here. Todd, hello.
Hi.
Hi. You have a question for our panelists?
I think the question is Ken still on there?
Yes, there
are. Yeah, I'm right here. I've made a valiant attempt to stick a few words in here, but I'm right here.
You've had the control of the floor most of the time, Ken. Let's hear from Todd.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, I've been involved in the course of the last 2 years with forming a 501c3 public-private consortium along the lines and interconnected with some of the California delegation to specifically address trying to retool. Congressman Berman had put together a feasibility study.
I didn't realize Congress people did feasibility studies for corporations.
It's not for a corporation, for public interest.
Well done.
Out in Burbank, there's currently a consortium, but it's both public-private, called CalSTART, which is a component electric vehicle component-based group. The problem that was posed to me through a Professor Michael Storper at UCLA, who had done the feasibility study, was that we don't have the manufacturing base here in California.
For an electric car?
Yes, because in other words, it's a viable conversion to take all of the very skillful jobs that we're losing rapidly in aerospace and defense here, mm-hmm. and take that personnel at least and convert to what is this imminent need of conversion. I think that the question and or I don't know what to pose it as a question or concern that hits very deeply for me is the impasse that we've already experienced in this process of where in taking this before at a very high level at White House level, there's a block that has been introduced by the lobbying effort of Detroit, who are not so willing to allow such readily available conversion to take place, not until they've immersed or perhaps positioned themselves in a in a larger than fair way.
Right.
And I think that that's something that you're not addressing, and I want to give you a specific example so that, that the audience has some reality check on this.
Okay.
One is that in the process of so doing this, on the private side, I've invested significant money to take a piece of technology out of Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is a direct liquid methanol fuel cell that's... as I understand and believe, state-of-the-art that would revolutionize energy for the 21st century.
Can you get your point, Todd, because we need to move along?
The point is that in all of the in the great ideas and schemes of things of defense and aerospace conversion, what we're still faced with is those powers that be that are and have been entrenched for some time in a lobbying position in Washington that are not willing to allow this conversion to take place at any kind of realistic rate of where jobs are being lost and need to be, you know, accounted for, and the economy suffering and waning in the manner that it is,
mm-hmm.
in a fast enough, you know, or in a proportional sense.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a very good question, and I thank you very much, Todd, for posing it. It's certainly not the first time in U.S. history that the auto industry wouldn't control industrial development in one direction or another. Isn't that true? Who wants to take that on?
Yeah, I alluded
Greg
to this
Michelle.
Earlier, and the issue of the big three trying to slow down the implementation of the clean air standards in California is clearly a battle that has to be waged for environmental quality, for changing our transportation system. CalSTART, which is a consortium of public and private corporations and governments out in Southern California trying to bring some of the assets coming out of the defense industry into an emerging market, planned on providing key components. It was not going to build the whole car. It was going to do everything from designing standard chassis to dealing with composites for fuel cells to other kinds of components in the new electric car, clean car, the zero-emission vehicle. It's a good idea. It's not dead. It's clear that the big three has blocked this initiative or slowed it down to some extent. Although I don't think this initiative has been entirely blocked by the administration by any stretch of the imagination, I think it's given it some support. I do think that this is a clear example of how difficult conversion is when you're trying to move two large industrial complexes, aerospace on one hand and the automobile industry on the other hand, into what really is an emerging industry, a very important industry. It's going to require organized political pressure coming from the grassroots to counteract some of these things. I do think there's tremendous opportunity in this area.
I have an answer for Todd.
From Long Beach, yeah, let's move along. We only have a few minutes left, and
okay.
We want to get as many people in as possible. Let's hear from Tony. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you very much. I'll be as fast as I can.
Thank you.
I would like to ask your guests there, are any one of them familiar with a document that came out in 1950, April, written by Paul Nitze with Dean Acheson looking over his shoulder, called NSC 68.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Very important document.
I can't say it rings any bells immediately.
Greg Bishak knows about it, but go ahead with your point, Tony.
Ring a very clear bell, because that was a document that was signed to convert to keep the U.S. on a permanent wartime economy more than a social economy. And it's not really a question, it's a comment I'm making. I'm supporting a caller that called previous that we have to have a economy that meets the basic needs of the people, the masses, than for corporate elite needs. Because in this document, they talk about how we need to suppress unions, churches, school, all opposing thought. And this document, if you read it declassified now, states how the U.S. economy will never, ever be converted to a social economy, always for a corporate military economy. And if that is the case, the pretext for U.S. Wartime economy has always been the Soviet Union. Now that cannot be used anymore,
mm-hmm.
so it cannot be hid behind the Pentagon anymore.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, George. I think we get your point, a point that's been made by a few callers. And it does speak to the underlying logic of such a large Defense Department. I mean, some people, Ken Flam, would argue that the whole attitude of defense is build it and they will come. In other words, build a weapons system and it will be used.
Actually, al contrario, you miss the point completely. You just don't get it. The bottom line is not build it and they will come. The bottom line is look for what we need in the private sector, in commercial industry, and we will go. It is just the opposite.
Greg Bishek, do you agree with that?
Were it only so, I think that the commercial military integration project, which is a nice idea that Perry and others, Secretary Perry, have proposed as a way to bring down cost of our military apparatus, might work in certain areas where off-the-shelf high-tech components can be integrated into weapon systems. But the fact is it's not going to help the General Dynamics who produce submarines or Lockheed to produce combat jets, except at the margin. I think that they also realize now that the armed services are very dedicated to maintaining their military specifications and requirements, and that implementing these things are going to be very difficult, and that in the longer term, we're going to still have a dedicated defense industry, by and large, maybe with fewer military specifications to be met. But a lot of this off-the-shelf stuff that King keeps talking about,
I'm not necessarily talking off the shelf.
Yeah,
I'm saying you can rely on commercial capabilities to manufacture and provide products that are tailored to defense needs as well. You can still get it out of the commercial sector, for the most part using commercial systems and, most importantly, commercial business practices.
Were it only so. I would encourage it. I think it's very important
Greg
to reorient the defense corporations to
good.
The cost and quality norms that are consistent with the commercial market, instead of the old military norms of essentially driven by performance and the military's technological requirements.
We're going to have to drop it right there. You get the final word, Greg Bishek. We're flat out of time. So much more we could talk about. But thanks to all of you very much, Greg Bishek, Ken Flam, and Carol Webb. Our thanks to Monitor Radio for their assistance and to all our listeners for their listening and their participation. Remember, you can contact us by email by addressing us at kpfa@well.com. Join us again next time. I'm Jude Tillman. And for the Communications Revolution.
The Communications Revolution is directed by John Rieger. The technical consultant is Tim Pozar. Our on-air engineer is Jim Bennett. Indigo Thumb is the administrative assistant. Music created by Tony Kniff. You can receive a free resource list for today's program by sending a stamped, self-addressed envelope to Pacifica Radio Archive, Post Office Box 8092, Universal City, California, 91608. Ask for program 894. This is the Communications Revolution.
Next on the Communications Revolution, quick, should we invade Haiti? Hit the right arrow on your TV remote for yes, hit the left arrow for no. Some critics think that electronic citizenship will be just that, well, simple. That's next time on the Communications Revolution.